Introduce yourself, please.
Good morning, Brian. My name is Kevin Corlew. I'm state representative from District 14, which is in Kansas City North. Happy to be here.
We're happy to have you. Let's play the open.
This is Statehouse Blend. I'm Sam Zeff.
And I'm Brian Ellison. We're using coffee
and donuts
to better understand the legislatures on both sides of the state line,
the issues and the people in Topeka
and Jeff City. Here we go. The coffee is hot, the donuts are fresh, and it's our first meeting with a state representative of the 2016 legislative session. Glad that it can be Representative Kevin Corlew, Republican from Kansas City North. And also joining us are Janelle Shuey, who she's a stay-at-home mom, lives in Brookside. Good to have you here, Janelle. And from my KCUR colleague, Donna Vestal, the Director of Content Strategy here at KCUR 89.3. Welcome, Donna. So, Kevin, we always start by asking our representative guest to tell us a little about themselves. Tell us about your family and your pets.
Well, I have a great family. I'm excited to tell you about them. I am married to my wife, Amy. We've been married about 20 years. We have three children. Gabe is 11 years old and in fifth grade. Amaya is 9 years old in fourth grade. And Eliana is 6 years old in kindergarten.
Wow.
All three of them are at Davidson Elementary School in the North Kansas City School District. And we have a couple of pets. We have a dog named Red. He is about 7.5 years old, a Beagle Lab mix. And then just over Christmas, we gave my daughter Amaya a gecko for Christmas, and her name is Terry.
Wow. You have your hands full at this, the Corlew household. It's a happening place.
It is. It's good times, though. Before I came here this morning, we were at a basketball game in North Kansas City for my son.
Wow. You've already had a big day.
Right.
How did you get hooked on politics in the first place, Kevin?
Well, Brian, politics has been an interest of mine from a young age, always following public policy and interested in it. The ability to be involved in the community and to help those around us and the opportunities to shape public policy has been an interest of mine. I was involved in my community, such as things as chambers of commerce, community groups such as our Homes Association. I served as a chair of our Homes Association and also served as a school board member in the North Kansas City School District. So it's been a progression of just being involved in the community and then seeing other opportunities to serve.
And now you're in your first term in the State House.
I am. Yes, I'm in my first term and just started the second session, and it's been an enjoyable one.
Well, we're going to talk about that second session. There's a lot going on. You've got some legislation you've been sponsoring that I know you want to talk about. The State of the State address was this week, so plenty for us to discuss. But let's start by going around the table and seeing what's on the mind of our guests. Janelle is our citizen who's with us this time around. What's on your mind, Janelle?
Well, I first of all, I congratulate you for serving. That's a really, to be a public servant is just a great service to all of us in the community. So I was just looking at some of the bills that you sponsored or co-sponsored, and I have a question about one of the bills on arbitration. I know that's kind of a hot topic right now with employers trying to keep legal costs down. However, I see that some companies are bullying, and I'm saying that with quotes around it, their employees into agreeing to enter into arbitration instead of going to court.
So the legislation that you're sponsoring in the legislature would require employees who have entered into agreements with their employers that they will use arbitration rather than legal resolution or judicial resolution to actually do that. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. The bill applies only if there is an existing arbitration agreement in place that the employer and the employee have agreed to. And basically what it does is that that you go through the process that you've agreed to, and some of the initial issues that now can sometimes be pulled out of the arbitration and decided at court, such as, is the arbitration enforceable? Are the issues that we're looking at underneath the the scope of the arbitration, those aspects will be able to be decided by the arbitrator. And arbitration has been a fair process that has developed as an alternative dispute resolution over a number of years. And it is intended to give the parties an opportunity to have a fair hearing between a neutral arbitrator and with the goal of keeping case times shorter and costs down. Typical arbitration often can be completed in maybe 6 to 8 months, whereas any type of a lawsuit, you're looking at a minimum of 2 years. So both from the employer and the employee perspective, the issues can be resolved quicker and more efficiently.
Janelle, you used the term bullying when you asked the question.
Right.
What did you mean by that?
Well, I think it's an unintended consequence of legislation like this that corporations might force employees to agree to arbitration for resolution instead of the legal process.
Well, I think that's it's a concern that some may have. I would say that the important thing to remember is that arbitrators are generally selected by each of the parties, that they can select on a mutually agreeable arbitrator, and that the process is governed by rules such as by the American Arbitration Association and is a fair system. Our Supreme Court has upheld arbitration and encouraged it in many instances as a fair opportunity, an alternative dispute resolution. And then also to keep in mind is at the end of an arbitration, the same rules that apply now under the Uniform Arbitration Act would apply, that if you have some reasons that you believe that a decision has been induced by fraud or there are legal errors in that you can seek judicial review of that. So you still have an opportunity to take the case to court after the arbitration is completed.
Kevin, you're an attorney. You do litigation, right?
I do. I practice at a firm here in town, Trocardi & Bacon, and I do business litigation and kind of in a variety of areas.
So is it in your typical client's interest to go to arbitration, or would you actually be better off if you could take them to court?
Well, often that's kind of an issue. I mean, for attorneys, often to go to court means longer times and more billable hours and things of that nature. But that's not in the interest of the client. Now, and in my personal case, I do not handle employment litigation, so this legislation would not impact my practice at all. But I just see the value of it from an efficiency and fairness standpoint.
All right. Well, let's continue around the table to KCUR's Donna Vestal.
I'm a fellow Northlander, so I kind of love to talk a little bit about what people don't know or realize about the interests up there. I was reading about the fight last year over right to work, right? And
right.
So you've been targeted in some billboards and some other advertisements, but I know your response is, obviously, you're representing the people in your district. And so I'm wondering, what was the reaction in your district? What did you hear? Have you had anybody come at you about those billboards? Or what's that been like? I mean, especially as a freshman legislator.
Well, the right to work issue was a contentious issue mm-hmm. last year, if you followed the legislature. But I heard from my constituents. I heard from people on both sides of the issue, obviously. But by and large, the majority of the people that spoke to me through letters or called me or people that I met just in walking our neighborhoods encouraged me to vote against the right to work issue. And something to keep in mind is that we have in the public sector here in Missouri, we are already a right-to-work state. So, mm-hmm. When you're talking about teachers and firefighters and police officers and public employees, we are a right-to-work state. But this law would apply to the private section. And there was a lot of folks that came out in my district and did not want to see government interfere in those public or those private contracts between employers and employees. So the response in my district, I feel like I followed what was the majority feeling in my mm-hmm. district. A lot of labor are represented in my district, mm-hmm. from everything from auto manufacturers to Harley-Davidson workers and railroad workers and former retired TWA workers and a lot of the trades. And so I heard positive remarks from them. You mentioned some of the targeted ads that have mm-hmm. come against me. And it is true that there were some people that were very passionate on the other side of the issue. And I respect their viewpoint. And and weighed all of that in my thought process.
Can we talk about the targeted ad? So, I mean, I went to the dentist on Tuesday. You drive by it every day, Donna. There's a billboard, right?
Yeah, there's a billboard. And it basically is saying you take money from unions, right, or from big labor supporters. And I know in your election campaign, I think you took a lot of pride in the level of small-level donations as well that came into your campaign. So I just wonder how that feels and how that plays out,
No, that's true. And the donations came from a variety of sources that supported me across the board, both business groups, labor groups, individuals. And so it was quite a cross mix. Now, the ads, however, are coming from one multimillionaire in the southwest part of Missouri who's not in my district. Mm-hmm. And a gentleman that had put up, nearly $500,000 just a couple days before the vote.
And not just you,
not
the
just
other
me.
Republicans.
Right, and had put that out there publicly, just kind of, I guess, as a threat or a reward, as well as how you might want to view that. But so it's important to realize that this is not a broad-based attack, but rather a very, from a very wealthy individual that's not in my district.
Yeah, I mean, just to keep following up with that, I'm more curious about that on a personal level than a political one. I mean, you drive by this billboard presumably all the time. It's got your face and a big word that says shame on it.
Right.
I mean, your kids see that. What's that like? You were a youth director at your church. I mean, you're just a guy. What's that like to have that experience?
Right. It is a different experience, to realize. I mean, that's part of politics, unfortunately, and part of Missouri politics, which has had a history of some of the ugliness in that. I think it's my son's friend went by there with his family, and his mother told me that the first words out of his mouth was, they are bullies, Mom. And, I think that really describes, unfortunately, what some of the tactics in Missouri politics has been. We teach our young people to get along and not to bully people and to work differences out. But unfortunately, in politics, you see some of that. And it's something that I want to change in the public discourse that we engage in and the way that I interact with people. And I hope that others will, too.
What concerns me as a citizen is to see these large donors who run a smear campaign, such as one that's aimed at you, and that these donors are actually helping people get reelected or not get reelected, depending on how you vote. And so I think instead of being even-handed and listening to the topics as a whole and considering them on their own merit— instead, sometimes legislators are bullied into voting one way or another to ensure campaign dollars.
That's a legitimate concern that citizens have and that you have and that I have. That's why it's important. We talk a lot about ethics and ethics reform. I think at root, the number one thing that we can do for ethics reform is to elect ethical people. And for that, it's got to be people that have a backbone and that will do the right thing even in the face of bullying or even in the face of campaign dollars coming against you, that you listen to your constituents. And that doesn't mean we always agree on things, obviously, but you do the right things that based on the information that you have, based on the information you've heard from constituents, and you make a decision. And whether that means that it has good or bad consequences in the election should not be the number one priority.
Governor Jay Nixon gave his last State of the State address earlier this week, and ethics reform was one of the topics that he addressed. In fact, let's listen to a little bit of that speech.
Missouri's ethics laws are a disgrace, the weakest in the nation. The people of Missouri are nobody's fools. They understand a donor who writes you a fat check expects something in return. They know it's wrong for legislators to launder campaign contributions by paying each other for political advice. Missouri's got to clean up its act. And I want to thank Speaker Richardson for pushing forward on this issue.
Words from the governor affirming House Republican leadership, Speaker Todd Richardson, for supporting a package of ethics reform bills that seem to be well on their way to passage, including limitations on lobbyists, representatives becoming lobbyists, at least until a year has passed, limitations on them accepting consulting fees for campaign advice, but not including the limits on large campaign gifts that a lot of people are calling for. Where do you stand on that package of legislation and on the possibility of campaign donation limits?
Well, I supported the ethics legislation that we heard this week and that we will continue to hear, the ones that you mentioned. I think those are important, that we not be able to turn around and become lobbyists just, you know, leaving our term. And I think that's important to make sure that we are showing people that we're here for the right reasons and not just to get a job afterwards. The other issues that you mentioned, and we're going to have ethics reform on lobbyist gifts and the limits that you can take on that. And the paid political consultants. I've supported all of those. I do think that in Missouri, one thing that we do have that a lot of states don't have is very strong disclosure laws, so that anything that a lobbyist might give or any benefit that a legislator might be perceived to be receiving is all being able to and must be disclosed. Also, we have strong disclosure limits on contribution or strong disclosure rules for contributions, so that any contribution that I or another legislator receives is in the public eye. Now, the next step, though, that you talked about is having to do with contribution limits. And I think that needs to be an area of discussion as well, because, you know, I think that it's important that we talk about, a $25 meal that a lobbyist might provide to a legislator. But I also think it's important that we talk about a $25,000 contribution or a $250,000 contribution or $1 million contribution, because that does have impact, as you mentioned, and it's important that it be disclosed, and it is, and that we discuss that. But I think if we're going to have the discussion, we also need to have that that discussion as well. To that end, I've been working on legislation. It hasn't been filed yet, but that would have some type of contribution limit, reasonable limits. I don't think that what we had in the past were contribution limits that were about $300. Well, what you would see is that instead of giving $30,000, they would just break that down into 100 different $300 contributions mm-hmm. from different sources. And then that's hard to track. So I think ultimately you've got to have some disclosure.
It's got to be higher than $300.
Right. And so what I've looked at is basically a $5,000 individual limit from in state rep races, a $10,000 limit in Senate races, and a $20,000 limit in statewide. I think that would be still reasonable, allow people to have their First Amendment rights and to be able to give their speech, which the Supreme Court has held that contributions is a form of First Amendment speech. But it also ensures that you wouldn't have one person, such as Janelle mentioned, basically dictating how an election will go.
You've said you are working on that legislation. It hasn't been introduced yet. Do you think it'll get any traction?
Well, I'm hoping that it will, at least that we'll discuss it and that it will be in the mix. I think all of this is open to discussion, and I hope that it's a reasonable discussion. Senator David Pierce has a similar legislation with some different limits than I do, but some different limits in his legislation, but it's the same principle.
The leadership of the majority, the Republican majority in both the House and the Senate, has opposed that sort of legislation up till now. Do you think that's changing?
Well, I think there's a recognition amongst leadership that we've got to do the right thing, not only to be perceived to be doing the right thing, but to be doing the right thing to make sure that we're cleaning up government and being ethical. And I think that they're certainly open to having that discussion.
I noticed that before you were elected, you said a couple of your priorities were the school transfer law and health care, things that have come up against differences of opinions like that. Have you changed priorities? What is your hope in those areas?
Well, I think that we worked hard last year on the school transfer bill, mm-hmm. and that was a very important issue, particularly for our area, the Kansas City area, and in the Kansas City public schools and the surrounding schools, such as the North Kansas City district on which I served on the school board. We worked hard to find consensus and to really take a lot of issues that different sides had in that and try to come together with a real good piece of legislation that allowed that.
But it was vetoed.
And it was vetoed, unfortunately. And despite that, the governor had said that he would support that, and again, did not engage with the legislature early in the process on issues that he took. I still think it's an important issue. And unfortunately, what happens with the education bills is that the perfect becomes the enemy of the good. Because there are different interest groups, they all want the perfect piece of legislation, but you have to realize we are a political body. We have two chambers, a House and a Senate, and often what you have to do is compromise and come out with a good piece of legislation, but maybe not one that's perfect in the eyes of each of the stakeholders.
You mentioned development in the Northland, and how I do not live in the Northland, but I was interested in something that was mentioned in a bill that you were suggesting on community improvement districts. I guess as a taxpayer, I see community improvement districts as regressive in that they impose usually sales tax. And so sales tax is, of course, a regressive tax. And community improvement districts sometimes are made up of areas that have a very low voter polling area. And yet the people that the districts are culling money from is much larger than that. What do you think about that?
And I'm trying to think, Janelle, is there a particular bill that you were looking at? I don't know if I've worked on anything specifically with the community improvement in districts.
I think it's something that was mentioned on either your webpage or your Facebook page, something about and maybe in the future creating community improvement districts in the Northland.
Okay. I haven't dealt with that issue a whole lot. I mean, I do think that sometimes the type of districts that are set up for economic growth, whether it be the enterprise districts or the community improvement districts, are a way that communities can join together and see a specific need and raise the interest in that and raise the necessary funds to move those forward. I'd have to look at the particular, you know, instance that you might be talking about to give more specific on that.
Well, even more broadly, I mean, you're the vice chair of the House Economic Development and Business Attraction and Retention Committee,
right.
Which I assume mainly just looks for somewhere that can print business cards large enough to accommodate the name of the committee. But I mean, how well is Missouri attracting and retaining business today? Governor Nixon mentioned that in his State of the State address, said we're the number one state in new business creation. And in fact, that was the moment in the speech when he said the state of our state is strong. Do you share that rosy outlook? And to what do you attribute that?
Well, I think we are doing well in terms of business growth and bringing businesses. We have a lot more to do, obviously, and we're going to keep pushing for that. One of the areas that I've seen a lot of growth in is the entrepreneurship community, both here in Kansas City and throughout the state. We've really put an effort into making this an area where you can grow a company, and I think that's important. I think that sometimes states get caught up in trying to lure the big company here and getting into these battles and you know, trying to open up the coffers and maybe, you know, bringing in a company but losing ground in the long run. I think it's more important to grow your economy through small businesses that can raise up and grow and hire more workers. You know, more than 60% of our workers in the workforce work at small businesses. And that's where I think you'll see the growth and we'll continue to see.
Mm-hmm. Bravo. I agree. I also had a question about some legislation on unborn child protection that you helped co-sponsor. So what do you think about the Kansas appellate court ruling yesterday?
So just for our listeners, the Kansas Court of Appeals ruled 7-7, actually, which means they upheld the lower court ruling that struck down or put on hold enforcement of the Kansas legislation that outlawed the dilation and extraction method of abortion. So that remains on hold in Kansas because of that divided court ruling in the Court of Appeals. It'll probably go to the Kansas Supreme Court. So Janelle would like to know what you think of that.
Right. And we have similar legislation that has been proposed here in Missouri. I haven't read the specifics of the Kansas bill to know what the differences are, but I know that that decision was based on a Kansas Constitution. But I think that, you know, with this issue, it's a public policy issue where you're balancing the rights of the pregnant woman and the rights of the unborn child, and this particular legislation is not aimed to outlaw abortions, but rather to make sure if it's done that it's done in a humane way, and that these type of dismemberment abortions are curtailed, and so that we're recognizing that. We are recognizing the life that is developed at that stage. And then, so from a public policy perspective, though, that's a decision that, tough decision that lawmakers generally make, that public policy, and that public policy is to be made in the state legislature, and we'll be debating that and talking about that even this session.
I guess my thoughts on that are that we're still trying to legislate laws restricting what women can do with their own bodies. And I think that seems fairly regressive in this day and age. And I thought it was interesting that part of the legislation then restricts the provider from providing any other services while the issue is being fought out in court.
Is this the Kansas legislation?
This is the
Missouri proposed.
Yeah, this is the HB 1714.
Well, you have to, in any legislation, you have to have a mechanism of enforcement, and those provisions are meant to that if the legislation passes, that there's a means by which, if there's violations of the law, that can be addressed in court, and that the persons who are violating that law can be a remedy for that, and just like any other type of law that has been violated, while the court proceedings are going on, the person that's the alleged offender of the law can't go out and continue to commit the same act that they're being prosecuted or that's being dealt with in the court system.
Sorry, Donna, go ahead.
No, that's okay. I was going to change track, and that's a
Please.
Hard track to change from with any good transition. But I want to ask you, I was in Target the other day, and I'm overhearing a conversation with a couple women or a mom and her older child that, oh, my gosh, you're getting on an airplane. Your Missouri driver's license isn't going to work, right? So, and I know the facts that they can use their driver's license right now, that it's fine. But I know you've proposed, I believe, legislation to have two kinds of ID, maybe in Missouri.
Right.
And I'm wondering if that might make it even more confusing for some people.
Wait, we've all been to the DMV in the last year, haven't we?
Yeah. It's hard enough to get one.
Yeah. Right. Well, here's the issue on that, Donna, and that is in 2005, the Congress passed the Real ID Act for improvement of security measures with identifications. And that was a recommendation coming out of the 9/11 Commission. And particularly in the 9/11 hijackers, there were more than 35 different identifications that they had from different states. And that was a problem that they found, that people could get, and then later, that people could get around the no-fly list by having an identification from a different state. But then in 2009, our state legislature had some concerns on some of the privacy issues and some legitimate concerns about some of the information that was being required. And so they passed a law preventing Missouri from complying with the Real ID Act. Now, the federal government gave us an extension on that and allowed that situation to happen for several years. But now they've said that we need to comply, and that the first aspect of that is that Missourians cannot use their Missouri-issued license or identification to get on a federal facilities. And so now we have situations such as businesses that are providing services on military bases here in Missouri are having to take additional identifications with them, such as a cable worker having to take an additional birth certificate with him or her
or
passport to get on the base. In 2 years, the transportation in flying will be we will have to have additional documentation. And I've heard from our constituents that have asked about that and would like to see a fix. So my legislation recognizes that some people do have the privacy aspects, and they don't want their source documents that they give when they go for their driver's license. They don't want that to be kept in any type of files, and they don't want their picture searched across other states to find out if they have a driver's license in other states. So recognizing that, what some states have done, and the federal government has approved this, is that they allow the individual to make a choice. And I think that's ultimately the best thing that we can do here, is to say that we will have a compliant driver's license with the Real ID Act, so that people that need to travel and travel freely will go on military bases will be able to do that. But then when you go to get your license, you'll be given the choice and be told what it means, and you can keep the current style of driver's license that you have now.
I imagine I'll hear more about this at Target.
Especially when someone tries to board a plane, yes, and they have chose the wrong one.
Well, and I think that will be incumbent upon our government and our Department of Department of Revenue at the DMV, that they'll be able to explain what the choice entails, and make sure that people know what they're getting and when they request it.
Thanks to our guests for joining us, KCUR's Donna Vestal, one of my bosses here, and the director of content strategy, and Janelle Shuey. She lives in Brookside. She's a stay-at-home mom with a handful of kids of her own to remember the names of. Thank you both for being here. And
Thanks
to you, Representative Kevin Corlew. One of the things that we do that helps us get to know you best is we ask you to help us end the show with a song that you think speaks to the moment or is maybe one of your favorites. What song should we go out with today?
This is the most exciting moment.
It really is.
We find out who listens all the way to the end of our podcasts and knows this is coming.
Right?
Might be a good time for an Eagles song.
Yeah. Oh, or David Bowie.
You're getting help from the guests.
Time this appropriate.
It's very democratic this way.
Well, I'm drawing a blank, Brian.
Actually,
this is such a lawyer response. I swear to God.
Actually, I think we might actually play this entire long silence. It's pretty entertaining. Yeah. So
if he can't come up with one, the guest can.
Right.
Yeah.
That's our backup plan.
Before.
That is our backup plan.
I will say that our
producer Matt Hodapp just said that what you're doing in your head is going through the lyrics of the songs to make sure there's nothing objectionable.
Oh, is it nice? And as a guest, I don't have to do that.
Right.
All right, do you want me to go to the guests?
Yes, go to the guests.
Okay, so the way
one.
This works is that each guest gets to make a suggestion, and then I, as the host, get to decide.
Ooh.
So, Janelle Shuey, what's your pick?
Life on Mars, David Bowie.
Oh, in honor of the late David Bowie, Life on Mars. Donna Vestal, can you beat that?
Oh, Take It Easy by the Eagles.
Take It Easy. Wow.
Got a little Glenn Frey love there.
Our producer, Matt Hodapp, points out that we did end last week's show with David Bowie.
Oh.
And so we have not...
And she is your boss.
And we have not honored Glenn Frey. And more to the point, Donna is my boss. So we're going with Taking It Easy. Thank you all for being here. Kevin Corlew, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate
it.
Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. You can find us on iTunes or on kcur.org/statehouseblend. If you use Twitter, that's a great way to keep track of the show and also the news from Jeff City, especially when they're in session. So follow me. I'm at PTS Brian. You can follow my co-host, Sam Zeff, at Sam Zeff. We also use the hashtag Statehouse Blend. You can find a shorter version of us on the air on Tuesday mornings. They make a little space for us on Up to Date every Tuesday at 11. That's on KCUR 89.3. And also this week, don't forget to join us for Statehouse Blend Live. It's KCUR's podcast party. That's Thursday, January 28th at the Westport Flea Market. It's there in the Buffalo Room. My co-host Sam Zeff will be there with KCUR's Steve Kraske and two Kansas legislators, and burgers, and beer, and a live recording of next week's podcast. The whole audience will be our citizen guest, so come be a part of it at 7 o'clock Thursday, January 28th. You can get more information at kcur.org. Any other thoughts or to be on the show as one of our citizen guests, shoot me an email at brian@kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. We'll see you next time.